Hello and welcome to episode 29 of our weekly podcast, Long Shots. Hello, Sharad. How's it going?
It's not too bad. Can't complain.
Great, man. And usual high-level house checks. Do make it a point to subscribe to our channel now. We are streaming on Spotify, Deezer, Apple Podcasts, and pretty much any podcast app that you like. So do subscribe so that you get that nice little notification every time our episode goes live. And today we'll do what we always do, discuss the key events of the week, which kind of took our attention and our interest, as well as also, you know, throw general rants about the markets, the economy, and how disconnected sometimes activities within the credit or stock markets can be to ground realities. Even though no one knows the reality, people still like to comment and form a view. On that note, let's kick off. You must be wondering why I'm starting on such a, you know, philosophical existential note, because me and Sharad have been struggling to understand what's going on with the Sensex and Nifty and all other benchmark indices. Is there any other in India? I think these are the only ones, right? In this past week, it almost touched, 39,000 points?
The all-time high. Yes. Sensex was the hit record high, and we're not complaining.
That's not complaining?
Yeah, we're not complaining.
We're wondering, though.
We're wondering, yes. Yeah. Obviously, there's so many ways to talk about this, from political narratives to rate cuts, potential rate cuts. We don't know. It's what, 3rd of April today?
Yes, a bit of heads up. As per our usual practice, we are now recording a day in advance. I don't think this is going to be a recurring trend.
No, it's just because of
pressing engagements.
Pressing engagements on Thursday.
Yeah, that we are unable to do that. So we'll give a forward-looking view on the rate cut, but I think by the time the episode goes live tomorrow...
Yeah, so just for some context, I think the MPC will come out with a rate cut or hike or rate status quo decision on Thursday, which is the 4th of April at around 2:30 p.m., let's call it.
11:45, actually.
Is it 11:45? Okay, yeah, 11:45, so a.m. 11:45 a.m. and we are recording 24 hours ahead of it, so some of it will be future-looking, so listen to it at your will and...
And you know, we would like to give a kind of footnote here that if you're right, we are going to say, I told you so in the following episode. And if you're wrong, we won't mention it again.
Yeah, no, we'll probably say that it was a bad decision.
Yeah.
So we can never lose this, right. Nor can you. So feel free to tell people whatever you feel is right.
Yeah, that's correct.
So yeah, no, I mean, markets are obviously gaining a lot of traction. All-time record high for Sensex, I think it touched this week, earlier this week, at 39,000 plus and change, nearing 40K. Why? Because I guess there are two big factors that people think about. One is a potential rate cut,
right,
ranging from 25 basis points to maybe 50, but I think 50 is far-fetched. Right. 25 may be possible, we'll talk about that. But second is, obviously, there's a political certainty narrative, which is also sort of inbuilt into it. Like, right. I think... these odds keep swinging, but I think the markets tend to favor another term for the incumbents. That sort of seems to be the overall market narrative that seems to be making more sense. But these are the two big factors, I guess.
Yeah, I think on the second one, it's interesting because polling starts on 11th of this month. And I think the final counting will be done by 23rd of May.
Yeah.
So we are still 2 months away from the conclusion. But I mean, we're pretty sure as soon as polling starts, noise would start getting in, and they would so that would be the period when political uncertainty again would creep back.
Yeah.
So I guess people are just booking their positions in a run up to 11th of April. I don't understand it. I think from a trader's perspective, obviously it's a gold
right
line,
the curve,
right curve. But yeah, I mean, as I think you and me both have a more value investing mindset, so we obviously don't tend to pay too much attention to those factors. Rate cut again, yeah, it'll be probably the second consecutive rate cut under the present RBI governor, Mr. Shaktikanta Das.
Yeah,
I mean, it's an expectation. Let's see if it comes out.
Yeah, and widely expected from economists as well, and sort of with inflation at what, 2.1% retail inflation, if any. For anything, hitting what, 2.1%, well below the 4% sort of target. So I guess that's another factor to justify it.
I mean, even if you look at inflation on a 12-month historical basis, it has calmed down considerably.
Yeah.
If you look at it on year-on-year basis, I think it was riding almost 4% plus, you know, the same time last year. So, yeah, no wonder. Secondly, you know, in terms of, I mean, I don't know, maybe this is also like a messaging tool, you know. I mean, I'm no longer very sure about the quote-unquote independence of RBI. So,
are you sure about the numbers though?
I know, I think yeah, the numbers are probably, you can take them at face value. What choice does one have?
We don't.
But yeah, definitely in terms of timing it, I'm pretty sure that might have some role to play into this. The last rate cut definitely had optical or timing oriented perspective, because the last rate cut happened was the first one after the change of leadership.
That would have been very funny if after Mr. Patel resigns and Mr. Shaktikant Das comes in at the first MPC meeting, he raises rates. That would have been like a pop-up.
That's exactly the point, I think. And in addition to that, I think the usual rally happens because in anticipation of the rate cut, financial stocks go up.
Yeah, and overall markets as well. And various schools of thought, I think we've talked about it as well. Right. But generally, yeah, when rate cut markets tank off, I mean, all mathematical spreadsheet model junkies lower their discount rate, all of a sudden valuation jumps up. I mean, that's the clearest mathematical way of looking at it. But there are so many ways to argue.
And you know, like surprisingly, there was this another interesting story. I think we included it in one of our cover emails recently as well, that I think Bloomberg published that Asian markets generally love April as a month to go bullish. I think they were looking at the Asia MSCI, Asia Pacific Index, of which the Indian indices form a small part. But there's this, you know, entire fiscal year and optimism in general that, you know, March is over and, you know, like companies are a bit more reassured of their outlook for the future. So everybody's a bit more optimistic in general in terms of commentary.
Yeah.
Obviously, in the Indian scenario, the local factors such as the rate cut and elections, probably, you know, things like, you know, even banking sector restructuring, like recently, the merger of three public sector banks kind of closed. So now that is going to be the second largest PSB after State Bank of India.
Yeah, that's
Bank of Baroda plus Vijaya Bank plus Dena Bank that happened.
Yeah.
That closed this week as well. I mean, that's the thing. And considering all of that, I mean, I always try to look at fundamentally if something has changed.
Yeah.
And I mean, there, I think there are more questions to be asked. Because I think there was a Liveman story recently as well, which talked about, you know, new projects, the capex going to new projects. It's 46% lower year on year for India.
Oh, year on year.
Yeah. So that's basically the investment that companies are setting aside, both across public sector and private sector. So, I mean, there is a slowdown. There's no doubt about it, right?
Overall, yeah.
I mean, there's a slowdown in the US. There's a slowdown in India, and obviously with the rate cut coming in India, there will be, I think, more expected capital outflows to the US. I guess US rates are expected to stay steady in the short term. So nobody can deny that. And a slowdown and a symbol of slowdown kind of going in concurrence with, you know, people buying in the major indices. I mean, there's obviously some sort of a fundamental fallacy there.
One can sort of argue that now with a lower cost of debt expected upcoming, so they probably expect a reversal in the year over year capex numbers, maybe not 43 down, maybe it's down, becomes down 20, and slowly sort of someday it probably even goes up from a year over year basis.
Right.
And people it's timing, right? People just want to front it.
Yeah.
People want to get ahead of that curve.
Yeah.
And then the herd mentality kicks in, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a trading mindset, right?
It's a
trading mindset, and it actually benefits a lot of guys.
Yeah, I'm not complaining as most, I think, mutual fund managers won't be complaining either, even if it's...
But do you forecast some sort of a major correction after July?
I think so. I mean, we've talked about, like, again, we're not sort of, let's not give our views, sort of put a disclaimer out there. We're not in the advising business, but I think there's a definite slowdown or correction that's going to hit the US and would be a major slowdown correction, which I think will come hit every other market. So, and fundamentally as well, I think there will be some major correction, and that a short-term correction following the elections and the rate cut noise, I think there might be an opportunity to get in there.
Get in there, right? Yeah, because I think already things are things have already become dearer at the moment. Right? Yeah. So one can wait out if one wants to take a major position till the election time is over.
Yeah.
And,
you were talking about it, which I found interesting, a big Supreme Court judgment.
Yes, yeah, I completely missed that. I literally missed it. I read about it today in the morning. And
yeah.
That's something, I mean, the background is, as many of the listeners might recall, that in February 2018, there was a RBI circular which actually laid rules for banks to take back their dues from quote-unquote errant borrowers. So it pretty much...
defaulted.
It pretty much told the banks, directed the banks, go to NCLT.
Yeah.
Right? And the Supreme Court pretty much deemed that circular as unconstitutional yesterday, saying that that is outside the remit of RBI. It's too broad. You just cannot tell banks to go to the NCLT. That's a commercial decision that they'll take as per their own short-term / medium-term requirement. So that, I think, was a kind of major smack on the wrist for the regulator. And from a market perspective, I think it's very interesting, because when in February 18, if you just look at the NPA disclosures starting from Q4 2018, there was a spike, and the spike was almost in the range of around 2.5 lakh crores.
Yeah,
and that was pretty much because of this circular.
Yeah, yeah.
And banks were like forced to recognize
NPAs. When was this circular? I remember. Is it February?
February 12th, 2018.
Yeah, yeah.
So banks were kind of compelled to recognize NPAs, because normally, there are a lot of these forbearance clauses which banks apply. So for instance, if suppose a 90-day period has gone by and you have already defaulted. So I mean, there's a set classification or some sort of a framework the bank would use to classify your loan as non-performing.
Yeah.
And there's a real consequence of that classification, because as soon as the bank does that, the regulator will push the bank for parking higher capital to back it, right?
Yeah.
Higher loss absorbing capital, basically.
Credit rate, everything.
Everything kind of, gets then plugged.
Yeah.
But I mean, even though I think the RBI, frankly, overkilled at that point of time, I think it was a positive thing in my view, because I think that pushed a widespread recognition and provisioning of NPAs on an accelerated basis.
Yeah, right. Which the system needed at that time.
Which the system probably needed.
Still probably currently needs.
Yeah, I mean, I think at least now the market has reasonable amount of visibility on how big the NPA crisis is thanks to that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a case of regulatory, overreach.
So yeah.
Good that it was checked.
Yeah.
That came in yesterday.
Big
story.
Worth sharing with our listeners. And with that, sort of let's move to the next item that we wanted to discuss.
Which
we can start with, which is the world's most profitable company, Nikhil.
Yes, the world's most profitable company. It's no surprises there. Saudi Aramco, the state-owned oil major within the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, $224 billion of EBITDA.
Yeah, $224 billion in EBITDA, which just for context and comparison, Apple 2018 reported EBITDA was around $82 billion.
Right.
ExxonMobil was $40 billion.
Right.
So, and this guy is $224 billion. So,
which guy?
Saudi
Who's
Aramco.
The guy?
Who's the guy?
Yeah.
Saudi Aramco. I'm the big. Obviously, and you're getting to see these numbers because they're going to the bond market.
Right.
So they've obviously. These numbers have been sort of kept secret, kept hidden, but now they've offered a glimpse into them. I mean, courtesy this bond market and road showing whatnot.
Right.
So obviously, very interesting company and very interesting kingdom. And I say kingdom because they're obviously massive government intervention. I don't know if intervention is the right word, but has a say in how Aramco functions. So it's not a like-for-like comparison exactly. When the state has so much of control. I mean, these guys fund some of their social and military spending for the kingdom as well. So they're obviously...
I mean, it's apparently Saudi Aramco, I think as per Fitch. Fitch is the one which came out with the rating report, right? I think it gave A+.
A+, yeah. Best in class.
Rating to Saudi Aramco. And the main point that they were trying to make was that Aramco contributes almost 70% of the kingdom's budgetary allocation.
There you go.
So, I mean, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is unique because I think there's no, like in most countries, citizens pay taxes. That's not really the way it works. If you are a Saudi national, zero income tax liability. If I think you are a non-resident, there is some marginal 20% income tax requirement. But the main source of income is the, you know, whatever is generated through oil.
Yeah.
So Saudi Aramco is like the centralized vessel for doing that literally.
Yeah.
So it's heavily taxed. I think I was reading that before Aramco announced their IPO in, which was supposed to happen, I think, originally in 2017. Maybe even earlier, I don't remember.
Yeah, 2017, 2018 they said, and then they sort of stalled it because they wanted to make that acquisition for which they're issuing these bonds. I think it's a chemical fertilizer company.
I mean, I think anyways, in this case, Saudi Aramco would have been a $1 trillion company. So from an IPO perspective, also it's unprecedented.
Yeah.
So yeah, that IPO pretty much got stalled.
Yeah, and now they're very sure, or well, they say that it's on track for 2021 latest.
Right.
And they're sort of making it a point that this bond issuance will not make anything. It's just important to issue bonds first and then hit the equity market. So they're sure. Let's see how they're planning ahead. And
But you know, like the tax rate which was applied on Saudi Aramco pre 2016-17 IPO plan was almost 85%.
That's ridiculous.
And I think it kind of then they kind of calmed it down to 50%.
Yeah.
So yeah, out of 225 billion, almost 100 billion plus goes to the Saudi government as their revenue accrual.
No wonder they use EBITDA when they want to make the story of most profitable.
Yeah.
What happens after tax?
That's correct. That's correct. I mean, that's the model there, right? I mean, effectively, I think the citizens are granted major social security and financial support from the state.
Yeah.
They don't have to pay any taxes. And the oil companies are pretty much state-driven and they are the ones who act as the primary source of revenue. And yeah, that's I think the present Crown Prince, MBS, basically that was one of his major points, right? That he wants to shake that status quo, that, you know, run companies on a more commercial basis. Also, I think, consider personal taxation.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, look, listen, I lived in France for 2.5-3 years. And France, I mean, it's not Saudi Arabia, I'm not saying that, but France also has a fairly socialist
mindset
or leaning, you know, in terms of productivity, in terms of benefits, and this current, in terms of holidays, you know, and this current guy, Macron, tried to shake that, and there was a major pushback because of that. So, and France is democratic, so he has to listen to them.
Yeah.
I mean, in Saudi Arabia, probably that's not an issue, but I mean, they have been systematically following this model for the past 60-odd years.
It seems to be working for them.
Yeah, as long as the bills are oil paid. Is driving.
Yeah, and now they're sort of financially diversifying, right? Big investors in SoftBank's funds and...
yeah, I mean, that's what this guy has started, right? Yeah. I mean, I think UAE, like Dubai and Abu Dhabi are the best examples of how, you know, diversification can also work.
Yeah.
They started almost 20-25 years ago that, you know, that let's make Dubai and Abu Dhabi tourism hubs.
Yeah.
So I think MBS has similar plans.
Yeah.
But obviously MBS runs a country which is much more oil dependent, or, you know, it's the same thing like in India, there's a lot of criticism on coal.
Yeah. Right?
That coal is something, it's kind of a sticky asset, and it's difficult to get rid of coal revenues, right? So it's the same story with oil in Saudi Arabia's case. And you know, things like Jamal Khashoggi, those things they're also distractions which come in between,
which
probably, you know, make the status quo reinforce itself.
Well, it's an interesting story nonetheless, right? And it will be one of the biggest IPOs if and when they do go public. I think bigger than Alibaba and whatnot, but I think the bankers on the IPO file right now are, I think, JP Morgan and Citibank.
Okay.
Imagine getting a piece of that, right?
Yeah.
So obviously it's being closely watched, and guys,
I'm sure they must only be like the lead global book runners. They must be having like 20 other banks just to support.
Just to support in Asia.
I mean,
distribution. Yeah, no. Yeah. So yeah, it's a, and this bond sale will obviously give some glimpse. And this is, and they're yet to file before the IPO, I think a year before, they'll file those additional disclosure filings, right?
Right.
Which you require. And that will give you a lot more color on exactly how that financials are, how many, what percentage of it is being paid out as dividends.
Correct.
How much is it, what is the exact realized tax, you know, taxation, what kind of, everything. You'll get the complete look at the book. So it'll be interesting. an IPO will be fun to watch, I guess.
And yeah, that's great. I don't know how long it will last, man. if suppose they are listing themselves on, I don't know which stock exchange they're going to choose.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're going to list themselves on like on NYSE or NASDAQ or LSE, the mainstream guys, I mean, the transparency and disclosure requirements are
massive,
so extensive.
Yeah.
I don't think they have the stomach to comply.
Yeah, that, yeah. I mean, but yeah, I mean, got to embrace it, I guess, disclosures. But yeah, no, that's a fair point.
Maybe these guys relax the requirements for someone like Saudi or Aramco. I mean, it's such a big stock to, it's such a big ticker to get on your thing, right?
Yeah.
They might say, yeah, okay, you are this is an ultra premium listing, you know, they might come up with that. By the way, this is all conjecture.
This is all conjecture.
Just having some fun.
As we started by saying, it's a little bit of a banter. So that's exactly how it is.
Yeah, so
and now we're talking about one oil producing giant and potential IPO. Let's go to another IPO, which ironically at least presents a story of non-oil consumption because it is in ride sharing.
Right, oh, Lyft.
Lyft. Yeah. So they went public on what? Last Thursday, was it? Yeah, Thursday or Friday was the first day they began trading.
Right.
And stock.
I think last 2-3 weeks, a lot of there were a few back-to-back IPOs right in the US market.
Yeah, so there have been 4 IPOs that were very heavily expected and anticipated in 2019.
Right.
Levi Strauss, who were coming back to the markets, non-tech obviously.
Right.
Then you had Lyft, and you have, so these two are done, and you have 2 more upcoming this year. The big boy is obviously Uber, heavily watched.
Right.
And then there's Pinterest.
Okay.
But 3 out of 4 of them are tech. So, I mean, let's just look at the 3. So, like, you know, the market chatter seems to be they've relied or sort of used the FANG stocks to carry most of the weight of the markets. And now they're going to sort of, now they're relying on these new 3 tech IPOs to sort of carry the weight. And
you have a name for it. I know that.
Yeah. What was the name?
Pull stocks.
Yeah. I coined that term. Yeah.
Yes.
Pinterest, Uber, Lyft, and Levi's.
Yes.
Yeah. Although Levi's probably is an outlier there, but nonetheless, one of the 4 big IPOs.
Yeah, and pull with a single L just does not work.
It doesn't add. Yeah. So you add.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
watch out for the pull stocks.
Yeah.
Remember you heard here pull stocks for the first time.
Yeah.
So don't forget that.
So now the open IPO price was $72.
Right.
And I think it opened out of the gates at 87 and change, up 21%, valuing it at $22 billion. And on day 2 of trading, it fell 12%.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's volatility already, but you would expect that. And I mean, what Lyft, obviously, we know the big things. Are they profitable? Absolutely not.
Right.
Are they showing growth? Yes.
Yeah.
They have about 39% US market share. But yeah, we've talked a lot about all these companies, even in the Indian context, who are not even close to making money.
Right.
Lyft, I don't think has even set a date or a milestone on when they think they will be profitable. So there's no sort of clarity there. And that sort of makes investors a little paranoid as well. But the stock is up and come out of the gates well. I mean, investors probably feel they'll miss the bus or something. And Uber's, I don't know if you think, do you think Lyft will give you a nice precursor into what potential Uber investors will look at? I don't know. But
I mean, it kind of gives a reference point for sure, right? I mean, because I think they're fairly similar, right? I mean, in terms of the model, I frankly claim ignorance in terms of the difference.
So do I to an extent, because I've never used Lyft.
Yeah.
It wasn't there in Canada when I lived there for all those 8 years, but I've never seen it in India. I don't know if...
But it is an obvious comp.
It is an obvious comp, for sure. It's an obvious comp. Works on the same principle. But I don't know what that model, if there are any intricate differences in the models.
Right.
But what is the same is they both make losses.
Right.
I don't know how they're going to turn it around.
Right.
They lost $911 million last in 2018. Obviously, that jumped from 688 a year before.
Right.
Revenue keeps doubling though.
Right.
So, yeah.
And I guess Lyft is also, I mean, I think Lyft is probably pioneering that entire self-driving piece.
That too.
I mean, that's also one of the big pieces, right, that they're
going
to crack. I mean, the thing is that, you know, to be fair, I think the most obvious answer for analyzing these kind of opportunities is that, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, I remember like when Snap IPO'd, a lot of hype and hoopla. I mean,
it fell off the cliff, right?
It fell off the cliff. Yeah, they did some product level changes. The app, I think, looked slightly different, and some celebrities starting, you know, who used to endorse Snap they said some mean things about it, and yeah, it just kind of fizzled away.
Yeah.
So, and I remember Snap, I think, the way they had described themselves in the prospectus was as a photography company or something, they call. Okay. Right. I mean, because, I think you recall they also had this Snap glasses. So,
oh yeah, I remember now.
Like, yeah, so they have that. This is a bit like, I think, below our generation, to be fair. I mean, I sound very ancient.
I've never used Snap or Snapchat or whatnot.
But, yeah, but I'm sure a lot of guys and girls are diehard
Snappers, or whatever they call it.
Let's not tag this, bro. I mean, you can't get more uncool than that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I'm not sure whether the poll will stick with the listeners. The snappers might, you know.
Yeah. Well, so. Yeah, no, it, yeah, point taken. But the way the Lyft stock has behaved in the last 2 or 3 is exactly like Facebook.
Okay.
And sort of went through that initial jump and then fell off and people started raising questions. But right. Now look at it where it is now, right? People who subscribe to the IPO are clearly in the green by a country mile. So people obviously think that there's an opportunity of missing out.
Yeah.
And that's enough, right? We talked about herd mentality. Like,
I mean, like, to be fair, I mean, like, Lyft is again not a tech company, right? I mean, Lyft is a transportation company.
It's a modified taxi service, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, maybe we have not looked at it from that perspective.
Yeah.
Maybe there is some story then.
Yeah. I mean, most funds and obviously sharp investors are buying it. So then obviously they've done their due diligence. When people put their own money, then obviously there's some kind of merit to it. But it's hard. Like, it's just so many counterintuitive pieces that show up these days where they're not making money. How do you make money? And we've talked about in the Indian scenario, right, with the food giants and whatnot. There's just so much. The consumer is the ultimate winner right now. Like,
I mean, you know, the thing is that like Amazon had a very similar story, right? For 20 years, they were not making any money.
Yeah.
But the difference, I think, there was that it was pretty much a monopoly. You know, like, it grew and grew and grew. And then I think people started noticing Amazon's power once it had probably captured, you know, 70 or 80% of e-commerce in the US.
Yeah.
Before that, nobody was even noticing. I mean, I think Amazon hit that sweet spot of when the internet was a new thing, you know, when tech products was a comparatively new thing, or a tech products available within the online realm was at least a new thing.
Sure.
Right. I think same story is with Netflix, right? Netflix kind of was like Amazon and Netflix had some sort of a first mover advantage.
Yeah.
Right. And their spaces did not get disrupted by a similar player during their meteoric rise.
Yeah.
But I think what, I think perhaps makes us a bit unsure about opportunities like Lyft is that, you know, right, because at the end of the day, I mean, it's you do have 3-4 big players who are doing that.
Exactly.
Right?
And a lot of countries have their own domestic players.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, I think that's where it kind of... Even Lyft is not 100% of US market, right?
It's 39%.
39%, yeah. Correct? So, I think Amazon kind of and Netflix, they hit that sweet spot at some point of time. And once they had scaled up to a certain level, only then the Amazon Prime Videos of the world woke up, right? And even in terms of e-commerce, I mean, in case of e-commerce, the pie is so big that you had these domestic guys like, you know, Flipkart, who are like just operating in a totally different geography.
Yeah, Snapdeal, Flipkart, right. Whatnot, yeah.
So, I mean, perhaps if it would have been that, you know, Lyft and Uber in this first like 5 to 10 years focused only on the US market and kind of, you know, scaled up there and achieved a certain size, then maybe, you know, at least a lot of this conversation around how fundamentally solid these opportunities are would not come.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting take on it. Yeah, no, I agree with that, a lot of it.
I mean, same as like Facebook, right? Facebook, I think, was the de facto social media for almost 5.5 to 6 years.
Despite not being the first mover.
Yeah, despite not being the first mover. But it captured everything and then... Yeah, it was only at the, I would say, when it kind of peaked, that's when Instagram came in, that's when, you know, WhatsApp came in, and they kind of formed their own niches, but Facebook's dominance was unquestionable by then.
Yeah, the and current, they themselves started off with a 100 billion valuation, if I remember correctly.
Correct. So, I mean, their utility, now, I mean, even like right now, most people might not be using Facebook anymore, but most people are on it in some form or fashion, right? So, that's the kind of ubiquitous impact that product had.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I was reading somewhere that obviously Google leads the world in terms of searches and whatnot, but I was reading somewhere that, I think was it US or somewhere, in terms of product searches, Amazon was ahead. So people were actually searching on Amazon's toolbar for products because they were willing to buy anyway. So that's sort of the niche that it's carving into, right? Like product.
And I guess, you know, if you look at like a typical, you know, Charles Munger, Warren Buffett school of thought, what's the moat? Where's the moat, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Facebook has a very clear moat, right? Amazon definitely has a very clear moat, right?
Yeah.
Does Uber or Lyft have a moat? I'm not sure because does, like, for instance, in the Indian context, does Uber and Ola have a like moat? Like, would you, what would you think before switching between the two?
Nothing. It's just price, and price can never be a moat, right?
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
Amazon basically, price obviously was the starting point.
Distribution.
But distribution.
Yeah.
Then the range of products.
Yeah.
The range of categories,
network effect, right?
You know, everything is under that roof. Whereas a cab ride is a much more commoditized offering.
Yeah.
There's no differentiation between, you know, there's hardly any differentiation between car A and car B, right? I mean, as long as it comes on time, as long as it's cheap enough. Right?
Yeah.
So maybe that's where kind of the disconnect comes.
Yeah. No, yeah. Ultimately, it's price and service, right? And those are not like sort of moats per se.
Right.
That's something that every company should aspire towards, right?
Correct.
Maximize shareholder value, keep customer happy and offer great service, right? I mean, so those are not sort of, so as to speak, critical moats yet.
Yeah.
I mean, if sort of regulation frameworks are something that Uber can leverage on, but I don't see it right now. So, but let's see, I mean, obviously.
Maybe these were the same questions that kind of crept up 10 years ago, you know, when these companies kind of arising.
Yeah, so we are not experts at this, so this is just conjecture and...
Because I was reading that, you know, this Jeff Bezos biography, in which like there's a lot of bandwidth in that book given to how publishers were pushing back so intensely against the rise of Amazon.
Yeah.
And because Amazon was basically negotiating such low prices and were discounting on the shelf, publishers were hardly making any money. But there was a time when publishers were like, if you're not on Amazon, then our sales just don't pick up beyond a
minute
because people are just buying online more and more. Right. And then the entire leverage in the conversation changed. Right. Similar thing happened with iTunes. Right. iTunes was like what it initially started as, OK, don't listen to pirated music. Pay $1 and listen to a track. Right. Publishers kind of on music record companies initially were probably thinking, OK, this is like a good way to kind of, you know, come to the end user without bypassing the. I mean, making sure that you actually get some money out of it.
Yeah.
But over time, everybody was listening to music through that,
yeah.
right? And the leverage changed.
Yeah. So
streaming came in, yeah.
Yeah. Who knows how it evolves, but would be close and would be good to watch and highly anticipated Uber IPO next. So we'll have a similar banter then.
Yes, yes, yes. That's true. That's true. When are we going to buy all of this stuff?
Right? I don't know.
We just talk about it.
I'm the consumer.
Yeah, we are the consumers here. Great. So, I think on that note, we can probably call it a day. And hopefully all the listeners enjoyed today's conversation as well. Do feel free to put in your comments, rate the podcast, and, you know, share, subscribe, and spread the word. Thank you so much. And this is Nikhil Arora.
And this is Shalit Tupran.
Signing off.